Are there further comments on the motion before us?
Well,
Representative Dix.
I wasn't completely clear on the infrastructure bill on that. I wasn't completely clear in your answer. I mean, I wasn't able to focus and develop the answer that I wanted with your answer. Is there any way you could summarize it?
Representative Dix, will you restate the question concisely, and Mr. Taylor, will you restate the answer concisely?
Well, Representative Bauman asked the question regarding fairly serious exposure and liability, and I wasn't able to ascertain an answer from counsel's answer as to Representative Bauman's question. Is that clear enough, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chairman, let me try one more time, Representative Dix.
Okay.
A public official, in carrying out his duties, may have liability, particularly if he does not act in compliance with statutory provisions, statutory law. He may even have liability if he were to know that the statute was unconstitutional. Let's assume that the Supreme Court of Oregon were to determine a statute were unconstitutional, and then a public official the next day or a week later was to take action based on the statutory law, even though that statute was unconstitutional. He would not have a good faith reliance in his actions in that case. The question I believe Representative Bauman was asking me is, if we were to pass into law this expanded criteria, would a public official, Dr. Bray, have a good faith reliance upon the statute so that he could not be held individually liable? My answer to that, I guess, is that he could be. And the basis for that would be the Attorney General's opinion letter of April 8th, where they had serious reservations of whether in U.S. District Court the expanded criteria would be upheld.
Thank you very much. Thank you.
Further discussion? Will you call the roll on the amendment to delete the expanded criteria?
Bauman?
Aye.
Bellamy?
No.
Dix?
Aye.
Miller?
No.
Hanlon?
Aye. The motion is adopted. Section 15. Appointment of examiners.
Right.
And it deletes the old.
Yes, Mr. Chairman. And what it does is, under the old statute, two competent physicians must be appointed to examine someone alleged to be mentally ill. That appears in the bottom of page 12 from line 35 through 44. This section, going to the top of page 13, lines 1 through 23, would set up a different type of procedure. Starting in line 5, a judge may appoint one qualified examiner, shall appoint one qualified examiner in all cases. On line 6, if requested, the judge shall also appoint one additional examiner. And then in addition to that, down on line 12, I guess if there's a dispute, then we would have the judge appointing a third examiner. So instead of having the potential of just two, having the current two, we could have one, two, and possibly three.
Dr. Bray, can you explain this again? I heard it, and I didn't understand it. And I was kind of worried about there only being one.
The problem is that evaluations often occur in the courtroom now with the two examiners and are very cursory, and it doesn't provide an adequate clinical evaluation of the patient. It was the recommendation, after hearing the testimony, the task force recommended that instead of having two not-so-good examinations, we put all of our eggs in one basket and have one good examination, providing that the examiner can go to the hospital where the place of current detention, examine the records, and interview the patient in a private setting, and then be available to the court as an expert witness based on that.
Where does it say that in Section 15 that the examiner can do that expanded investigation?
It doesn't say it in Section 15, but it is by dealing with the privilege statute and opening up the clinical record for the current period of holding, it would allow that to happen. The agency is asked to draft an administrative rule about that current holding period, and then much of this would be detailed in the administrative rule.
The examination, would you explain how you get one, two, or three?
There would be one appointed to do the examination. If the allegedly mentally ill person would have a right to select a an additional examiner if he or she wanted one, and the judge would also have that right if the judge felt that in some way the two examiners that had been selected were not going to get to the truth. So there's still a potential for there to be more than the one examiner.
Do that again. I'm sorry. My apologies.
Sure. If the allegedly mentally ill person, probably on advice of counsel, decides they need an additional examiner, that examiner would be appointed.
The only time they're not going to request that is when the original examiner brings back an opinion that they shouldn't be committed. What's the flaw in my reasoning there?
I would have to defer to somebody who's closer to that procedure. It's my understanding that
I've been through it.
Wait, okay, I'll defer
as a representative of okay. A person being put through it.
What I was asking was whether or not my question was, is there a timing problem? Does somebody have to make this request at any certain point in the hearing? That was the question that came to my mind. Or, in other words.
Well, I would wonder how it would work, because if it's requested, the judge shall means the judge doesn't have any choice. There has to be a second examiner appointed. I think you originally said the reason for this was it would be more efficient, and in most cases you'd only need one examiner. And I thought to myself at the time I disagreed with you. And maybe that's why I'm going back over and over in this and asking you. Am I incorrect? Did you say that there would only be one examiner most of the time under these circumstances? Or that's the way you saw it? Or the task force saw it?
Yes, this is the way the task force saw it. And I think one of the underlying motivations was a fiscal motivation, that this would not bring down a heavy fiscal impact if we had, in order to recommend one more complete examination, and hope that in most cases that would be sufficient.
It's just that I cannot foresee a time when the person being represented would not request that, or if that person were unable to communicate to his or her lawyer, that lawyer who is appointed by right, if I were that lawyer, I'd request the extra examination no matter what, to protect the rights of in an adversarial system to protect the rights of that person, and therefore committee members. Representative Bauman, do you have any experience in this area?
No, I do have experience in the area, and I absolutely agree with you. I mean, I have experience practicing with, not in this area, but where there were similar elements in the language of the statute that really almost imposes a duty on the attorney. And I really worry about achieving your purpose. And I'm looking at the other language and seeing that even up here on one, it contemplates at least one and not more than three. And I worry that we're going to push the maximum, because there's kind of a tiebreaker. If you've got two, differing opinions, then the judge may appoint one additional qualified examiner in cases where the judge determines it's necessary or appropriate. I suppose that's the worst case scenario, but I think Representative Hanlon and I are concerned that that may be.
Again, the reason was the task force felt, the majority of the task force felt that it would not be proper to limit to one examiner. And that this would at least offer that option. If it doesn't occur, it doesn't occur. But that theoretically, it could occur with one examination.
What was the purpose of the third examiner?
My recollection of the task force discussion of that was that the judges felt that at sometimes they might need an outside opinion or a separate opinion from what had already happened. It was not, there was no indication that would be a usual occurrence.
We may want to move on, but I'd sure like it if I could get some more information from other members of the task force, the rationale behind this section, because I'm somewhat befuddled. What are the fiscal implications of sub 3, cost of examiners paid under 426.250? Doctor, do you know what that is?
We're in our fiscal analysis. We're anticipating that there would be an additional hour for this one examiner, but that there would be enough instances in which there was only one examiner that it wouldn't be an increased fiscal impact. If your question is
who pays the examiners nowadays? Kingsley?
Again, Kingsley Click from the State Court Administrator's Office.
And also a member of the task force.
Presently, the cost of the examiners are paid by the county. And under this...
250, 426-250
is... Okay. The 250, 426-250 that's referred to here is referring to it as amended on page 20, which would make it the State Indigent Defense Board. On page 20, section 26.
It would be a total shift from the counties to the Indigent Defense Board.
Correct. And I think when Mike Hansen, who was the Indigent Defense Board administrator, did the fiscal impact statement, he had two parts to it. One, which was if you shifted the examiners as is now and that cost, and then if you added the cost of a third examiner, he based it on maybe in 20% of the cases a third examiner would be. I don't know if that's an accurate percentage or not, but then he had a cost to the indigent defense fund of
how many cases with one examiner based on the fiscal analysis? What was the assumption used?
I'm trying to remember what the fiscal impact. I was wondering if legislative did. I think it was about 100%. There would always be at least two, because what it would be the judge would point one. If that report looked like they were going to recommend that the person be involuntarily committed, the defense attorney would certainly be interested in having a physician come that might not come to that conclusion. And then if you had two opinions, one for and one against, then the court likely would try for a third opinion that would break the tie and help the judge come to the proper conclusion.
The chair would move to delete section 15 and place that motion. There are two parts to this. Number one is the 1, 2, and 3 appointment of examiners, and sub 3, which would shift the cost from the local governments to the state. The cost would remain of the present system with two examiners.
Well, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you want to add to your motion then, I don't know if you do, you might want to look at section 4 sub 1F on line 27. And I thought, Kingsley, maybe you can help if I'm just muddying the waters here. It looked to me like that section, it's on page 4, it says the State Indigent Defense Administrator shall do a lot of things.
That would be, Representative Bauman, that would be included in the motion. We're acting in a conceptual manner. Before we got through with this bill, we'd certainly want to clean up all references, and you are correct.
Do you, then what you're conceptually doing is omitting sub F as well?
Correct.
Thank you.
Is there further comment on the proposed motion? Dr. Bray, should this motion pass? I'm just trying to put us in a spot to be where we're at when we get the bill out of this committee. If you can come back with the rationale on this that would better satisfy at least me between now and the next time we hear the bill, please do. Counsel.
Is that adding things that are there now? What qualifications of an examiner must be?
And he comes back and says he's insane. The other guy has a right to quote. So we have two.
Okay. I don't know. Maybe he pulled. He might have pulled it out of somewhere else. Okay.
And it is the judge then controlling that. There is the potential. Yeah.
Okay. What are
you saying? We should leave the language.
In other words, if we just delete this, there's no additional qualified.
What's wrong with your language?
Well, it could be if you're talking to examiner.
I was going to at least tell them that there is a potential third already.
What if they both say the person's sick and one would have said that's the circumstance where he's potentially sick?
The present system we have, the motion pending, the present system we have is we have two examiners.
That's right.
Yeah.
And those two examiners give their opinion, and the judge ultimately makes a decision based on those opinions. Sometimes both examiners agree. Sometimes one does and one doesn't. Both agree that the basis is there for commitment. It's highly likely the person will be committed. If one agrees and one disagrees, It's highly, it's within the judge's discretion, and the ultimate legal decision is with the judge. They both disagree on the criteria. It would be unusual, but I've seen it happen, that that person would be committed. So that's the present system. Yes.
Excuse me, Mr. Chairperson. That is the correct. I was going to note that under the current system, there is a potential for the third examiner if it's requested by the allegedly mentally ill person or their guardian or attorney, etc. But I think the reason that that happens less is if there are two appointed by the court and the two concur, then there's less likely to try and fight that with a third than if you have one and they go one way or another.
Mr. Chairman, I think one more attempt to answer the rationale. I think the rationale here was much more clinical than legal. The concern was that from the clinicians, from the psychiatrists on the task force, that the clinical evaluations were not adequate, that were being performed in the court in a very rapid way, and that we should attempt to find some way to, this is not consistent across all courts in the state, but that in some instances it was occurring that way, and that we should move in the direction of a more adequate clinical examination.
Mr. Chair, that is, well, there are a couple of rationales I think that task force used, and there were a lot of trade-offs, and, you know, I've been trying to see rationales, and not my opinion. my recollection was, one, the main concern with the examiner process was that it's usually conducted in court at the time the examiners are there just hearing what's going on. There's no, in most counties, no pretrial, and that's dealt in the next section. So there was a thought if it was done ahead of time, maybe there would be a more competent examination. The other reason that they thought that there would be...
Section 15 doesn't deal with that in any way.
No, Section 16 does, yeah. The other thing was that because of some changes in the rules of evidence, the admittance of and the possible subpoena of the investigator and treating physician, others, that maybe there would be enough other, quote, expert testimony or evaluation present that that coupled with one examiner's opinion would be enough. And I think that was also part of the rationale that, and then I think the last rationale is by doing all those other things, you were adding costs into the system. One way to help cut some of the costs was if you felt there was enough information available, then eliminate one examiner.
If who felt that?
If who felt that
there was enough information available?
Well, at that time, it was if the task force felt there would be enough, and then ultimately, if the legislature feels that there's enough.
However, the way this is written now, the decision on whether there's enough or not
in circumstances,
is in the arms, or yeah, is within the... the decision-making is within the discretion of the person who is to be committed.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't foresee that they would not request the second examiner.
Oh, Mr. Chair?
Representative Bauman.
I can foresee that they wouldn't if yeah, the initial examination were to come back and recommend that there not be mm-hmm, a commitment.
Correct. Except for that circumstance.
Oh, I think that's...
In which case, we mm-hmm, would hope these don't occur often.
Mm-hmm. All right. I was trying to offer what was some of the reasoning why they could do with just one, and I know that there were others that had concerns, and that's why they ended up with more.
Mm-hmm. The motion is before us to delete Section 15. Is there further discussion?
Can I make one other comment?
Sure.
I think there are probably circumstances, and this, I'm sure, is open to a vast kind of variation. I've read the old language over again, and I'm kind of persuaded by Dr. Bray's comment about the object of making sure you've got
at least one qualified person. I'm looking at in lieu of one of the physicians, the court may appoint one qualified person, blah, blah, blah. It does seem to me the other, in addition to be kind of concerned at the criteria, or absence of criteria for the qualification of the examiner, that there are probably cases where the report, where one report is, would just pretty much blow away a defense attorney. I'm not speaking of legally or, you know, reducing them to not standing up for their client, but I'm speaking of a factual basis where then the decision would, it would not be a, the kind of decision that would be based in any intention of strategy, but would be the decision of the mentally ill person. And again, that might save some time and expense in examination. I've talked myself out of voting for your motion.
What is it that you wish? Representative Bauman, how would you amend it? Or do you, or you just want to leave section 15 there?
Yeah.
Including the fiscal shift of all that money into the indigent defense fund?
No, I don't want to shift. I would like to
Chair will withdraw his motion.
Sub 3.
Chair will withdraw his motion and place Representative Bauman's motion to delete section 3 of section 15. Comments? Objection to that motion? Hearing none, it's adopted. Representative Dix and I have to be back here at 6 to begin another hearing. Our turtle's pace on this bill leaves something to be desired, but we will keep working, and we're going to set aside a block at 1:30 on the next time this subcommittee meets, a block of 2, maybe 2.5 hours before we get to any other bills, and we're going to work through it. So with that, is there further matters to be brought before the committee? Hearing none, we're adjourned.